In the Thick of It, a Profit and Loss podcast with Colin Lambert and Galen Stobbs.
Welcome to In the Thick of It, Profit and Loss's weekly podcast with myself, Colin Lambert, and as always, Galen Stobbs, editor of P&L in New York. And Galen, we're back. 1 week off. I hope everyone missed us. I'm sure they didn't. So we thought we'd start off this week. We had our usual, 30-second prep for this chat, but I thought we'd start off this week. You got some really interesting feedback on a couple of stories we posted over the last 2 weeks. The first one being on the last look-ish type function in futures markets.
Right. Yes. So, I mean, a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month ago, we kind of talked about how I was getting some heat on social media for kind of comparing some of the arguments about asymmetrical speed bumps to last look, even though I wasn't, other people were, and I was saying that people were comparing the two. Anyways, so I'm not going to kind of go through the kind of the pros and cons of that too much, because that's outlined in the article, which is. Came in a little longer than I would have liked. It is an in-depth piece, but
Someone yesterday at our conference said to me, "How long is that article? It's 25 pages on my phone." It's not that long. You should have seen it before it was edited down.
Yeah, there were a few ins and outs. I tried to be thorough and give both sides of the argument.
It's a really good piece. You had to.
But so one of the comments that I got back was someone saying, this being kind of the asymmetrical speed bumps, this is what happens when the market maker is employed by the exchange. They were arguing that, the market maker is now guilty of front-running orders because they're aware of the order flow. Now, I don't want to get into that second point because that's kind of dealt with in the article, but I did think it was interesting, the idea of them saying, this is what happens when the market maker is employed by the exchange. Because I guess the question I wanted to put to you is, do you think that on the kind of the futures, on the exchange traded side, that the kind of incentives have been kind of skewed or misaligned to a point where, exchanges now, have to cater to market makers so much because that's who effectively pays their bills, that it actually is to the detriment of the kind of the end user? I mean, whether it's, offering them in theory, co-location is available to anyone who can pay, but really it's the market makers who are gonna do that. Whether it's selling them the data, whether it's whether it's ICE or even, we've seen Eurex, and we're gonna be doing a piece on this next week. Eurex has launched a similar type of kind of, they're calling it a protection order type mechanism. But again, it's to try and, for kind of smaller contracts that haven't necessarily got the take up that the big ones do, to kind of protect the market makers, to encourage them to make markets and build up the flow there. I mean, is this a good and worthwhile exercise to protect the market makers, or is this really just exchanges looking after themselves? And have we got to a point where their need to cater to the market makers is disadvantaging the kind of the end user trying to hedge products?
That's an interesting question. I think it's quite complex, because I think one of the reasons why the exchanges will even start these programs is because they need to get liquidity into a new contract. So part of it, I think, is a historical legacy of, we got a market maker in the inducement program that's going to run for a year, then they extend it for 2 years, and all of a sudden it becomes kind of the norm. So that kind of gets them in bed with the market makers. They do need market makers because they need something on their screens. That's the big thing. You see, when it was on the floor, it was less of an issue because, a guy could stand up on the floor and go, okay, I need a price in, 3 months, January pork bellies or whatever it is. Quick Dan Aykroyd reference. so I didn't see that one coming. So I think there's this historical sort of legacy from protecting the market maker on the basis it was just they wanted to get these guys quoting and they need their screens to have prices on it. I think they do what they're recognising here effectively is something that the foreign exchange market recognised over a decade ago, and that is that high frequency latency arbitrages are not healthy for the market environment. Yes, they bring market efficiency, but actually you could argue what's wrong with a slightly inefficient market when it comes to price. So one guy's a little bit away from the other guy, and there's an arb there. Well, that means that customers on both sides of the price can actually get an improvement. And at the moment that people take in that improvement are trading firms with great technology. And that, I think, has been seen often as the biggest hindrance to growth of these markets in certain products because end users start complaining. They're like, yeah, like, you know, I'm a natural hedger. I can't get my hedges done because every time I try and hit something, there's one of these, you know, HFTs in front of me that's traded in front. So I think in a way this, yes, it does protect the market maker. And I think that's an interesting spin from the exchanges, you know, pushing in that way. But I would have said that they could also argue that this is protecting that end user hedger anyway by saying, well, with a speed bump, it's leveling the playing field for you and that HFT that's always jumping in front of you. If you hit the price, you've got a good enough, you know, you've got a real good chance of getting it done there because they're making it less attractive for the HFT arbitrages to trade in this market.
So this actually segues. This segues nicely onto another comment that was raised by this article, which is someone commented that it's ironic that the exchanges that caused the latency arms race and created a whole latency-based industry will have rendered the data pretty much useless. So there's a couple of things I want to get into there. One, you know, is this you're talking there about kind of protecting people from the HFTs? Are the exchanges now trying to kind of tame the monster that they created?
Yes. Absolutely. It's just a question of whether they can actually get the horse back in the stable.
And secondly, one of the issues we raised in the article, which was, you know, some of the trading firms who use the exchanges were saying that if they have any mechanism that makes it less deterministic, right, effectively devalues the data that they pay the exchanges so much money for. So Two things here, I guess. One, kind of, do you kind of agree with that assessment of it's ironic that this has happened? But also, I mean, market data is a big revenue stream for a lot of the exchanges, right? If they introduce these mechanisms, talk about, you know, the monster they created. If they do this, right, are they kind of in a little bit kind of killing the goose that lays the golden egg because they make a lot of money off the market data? But if the market data is, if people decide it's not valuable because it's not a deterministic, I can't build my quant models off it because I don't necessarily know if that order is going to definitely hit. Is this kind of choking off one revenue stream for them potentially?
That is an interesting one because I think, yes, in a way it is. But then think of the people that need this, you know, ultra high frequency data stream anyway. Partly it's the market makers. So actually they're taking with one hand and giving back with the other. But it's also, again, this HFT arbitrage is relying on the market data feeds to actually to drive their models, fuel their models. I sort of look at it. It was interesting to me yesterday on a panel. We had a panel on data yesterday at Forex Network London. And a couple of guys there were saying, actually, they think the market is shifting away from this ultra short-term trading because of speed bumps in FX, and more people are thinking in terms of, okay, I can make my money, but I can make it over longer time horizons, and therefore the market data and the market impact for that matter are less important. So I wonder if what they're trying to do again is this is part of a broader plan to say, look, let's get away from the image we've created, and we actually, as you quite rightly say, we actually, you know, created this monster. Let's get away from this by trying to make it, easier for the medium-term hedger, the actual real hedgers, the actual end users.
But how much do they actually want to, you know, to kind of choke off this trading, because ultimately exchanges make money when there's more volume, right? HFTs and these kind of latency arb, they create volume. Now, whether it serves a practical purpose or not is, when you're looking at a pure revenue perspective, is almost irrelevant. So, I mean, do they really want to put it back in the box completely, or is it just about now they need to find that right balance?
I think they're talking to that new generation of HFTs, for want of a better phrase. These market making firms that are traders as well as market makers, that are quick, they're tech savvy, but they sort of have moved into what you could call loosely like the responsible citizen stage of their development, you know, as opposed to like being out there and just kind of picking up these little arbs everywhere. They're actually now going to actually want to do this because they've got this correlated risk model which works really well futures markets are perfect for that sort of model. But I don't want to keep on spending, you know, millions of dollars on my tech to get to keep up with the guys. I mean, someone was in the video interview I did with David Mercer at LMAX Exchange recently. Yeah, you know, we're talking about, you know, people getting the satellite, you know, groups of clusters of satellites, so they can actually trade quicker between two locations on Earth. Do you want to spend that money to keep up if you're actually a good market making firm or a good trading firm? I think part of the gamble is they'll look at firms and say, you know, actually we want to get away from these small, you know, archetypal five guys in a garage in Texas.
Yeah.
Operations towards these big market makers, perhaps even the banks, but these big market makers who have now evolved into organizations employing, you know, 1,000 people or whatever, and, you know, starting to, you know, with serious profits, and they're making markets across everything. You know, if you look at someone like XTX, their submission letter to the SEC, I think it was in January, maybe wrong on that, was very much pro slowing things down, and they're very pro speed bumps.
Yeah.
So I think the exchanges are maybe taking a punt that those type of firms are the future for them. And there's also the argument, it could be that, you know, I mean, how successful are these HFTs going? Because we found in FX, speed is good, but it, you know, doesn't necessarily, once people work out what you're doing, they funnel you off into a liquidity pool where it's just HFTs. And as we've said many times over the years, the last thing an HFT wants on the upside of a price or in this liquidity pool is another HFT.
Well, that's why, and this was brought up in the article, that the FX is one of the reasons why the FX and futures kind of comparison isn't ideal, which is, you know, I brought it up to one person, and they said, actually, FX is a lot more self-policing in that regard because you have all these differentiated liquidity streams, right? Whereas in a futures market, you don't get that option on an exchange to be like, all right, I don't like, you know, I can tell that this guy's flow is bad. I'm going to kind of wall them off from what I'm seeing.
Yeah. I mean, you're 100% right. I mean, I kind of have a little bit of an issue with cherry picking, because I think it's getting with cherry picking flow at too many levels now. But ultimately, I think this is a bit of a risk by those exchanges in terms of, as you quite rightly point out, their business model. But I think they're probably looking at this as saying this is a longer-term game. They see the future as being, you know, market makers like an XTX or a Virtue or someone like that, who maybe are not quite so obsessed with speed. They want to sort of, you know, generally make markets to end user clients, and they don't want to be picked off by HFTs either. They're making a play for that type of firm, and at the same time, and they haven't done it, which I think is interesting. They could have been dressing this up as, we think this will make for, you know, more confirmed or, you know, robust execution for genuine end users.
Yeah.
We'll see.
And then another article that we got some feedback on was, we did one on CTA performance.
What, trend followers?
Yes,
someone said yesterday, mate, they're dead, so we can give up on that argument.
Mate. Firstly, we haven't given up on that argument. Secondly, the CTA industry, as you know, if you'd read the article, Colin, is moving away, it's kind of evolving away from just that pure trend following model.
And when I read that, I went, yeah, well, there's a good reason why they're doing that, because they're not making any money and they don't think they will for the next decade.
One of the comments that got made about that article was that, you know, investors aren't willing to put money with small managers with new approaches. There's, you know, these firms that have been around for decades still plugging their kind of overly simplistic linear approaches, the same ones they had 30 years ago. They're saying these firms have no incentive to change, and they've become asset gatherers, transferring investors' wealth to themselves. Now, the asset gatherer thing is something that I hear a lot, kind of, and not just limited to kind of big CTA, that's kind of a broader issue. But the idea of, and I'm kind of, there's an article that I've got kind of just percolating a bit at the moment about kind of allocators and where that's going and the challenges with being kind of small or kind of too specific to one asset class. But the idea of it, life getting harder for small managers is something that I hear a lot. And actually, when I was writing this, it didn't make the article because there wasn't room for it. But one of the comments I had speaking to one of the kind of firms that kind of analyze this space and consults and advises allocators and asset managers, you know, they were saying that it's actually a little bit of a joke sometimes when they speak to these big firms, and they're kind of okay, we want to make an allocation, and they draw up this, you know, this big list of managers, and they kind of want to do their due diligence and research on each of them. And this person was saying to me, it's a little bit of a joke because judging by the size of the firm, I can tell them in 3 minutes, right? There's only five, when they're that big, there's only five or six names that are going to tick all the boxes that need to be ticked for that firm to invest, whether it's from, you know, their compliance team, whether it's from like the size of them, as you can't be a certain percentage, over a certain percentage of their AUM, whether it, you know, there's all these certain tick boxes that have to be, that you have to meet to be able to be allocated to from these big firms. They're like, I don't know why they do this whole, you know, this whole charade of kind of like, oh, we're going to search and look through all these managers. He's like, there's only five or six names. Just look at those. I can give you the list right now.
So they're ticking their own boxes.
Yeah.
The charade is them ticking their boxes.
It's ticking. Yeah, I guess so.
To protect themselves if something goes wrong.
I guess so. It still seems like a very pointless exercise.
Oh, I mean, on a broader... Sorry, is there more feedback from that?
No, that was the main point there that I wanted to get out.
On a broader sort of note, I actually think I have a bit of a problem with this thinking around hedge funds and asset managers. And I noticed like this week there was some rumors of UBS Asset Management and Deutsche Asset Management looking to merge. And it'd be like 1.3 trillion euros of assets under management. And you think it just boggles the mind. But I think there are issues around these managers getting too big. And it's literally, they're functioning. We're talking about a market now where there's more transparency, the market data is available. Yes, there are algos available, but there's only so much liquidity. And they keep on, you know, the point you made there was a good one. You know, they can't be too high a percentage of the managers' assets under management. That's fine.
Yeah.
But if you create a huge global macro hedge fund or a huge asset management company, what about the percentages of the market that you are? Because that becomes a problem. It literally becomes like turning a 200,000-ton oil tanker. Because you're going to go into the market, if you've got, I don't know, 400 million, just 400 million in a strategy, could you imagine if you turn that? You have signaling risk and have market impact. There is actually a question of how long can it take you to get it done? And the firms just become too big to operate in the markets. And I think some global macro hedge funds found that probably 5 years ago when liquidity sort of took a bit of a dip. And, they underperformed because they couldn't literally – they're just not nimble enough in the market. They're leaking too much information, which means that, the slippage ends up eating into their alpha. To me, I think – it bothers me that the allocators are thinking this way. The other thing I think, and it's something that you and I have discussed before, I don't think on the podcast we've discussed it before, is that when you get into those smaller managers, that's where a lot of innovation comes from. You know, they're small enough, they're nimble enough, they can think a bit differently. And your point on CTAs going to a different strategy is well made, but it's taken, four, five, nearly 10 years of horrible performance for them to actually turn around and go, you know what, we might need something different in this trend following. And, of course, the law of sod states that the minute they do this, there'll be some trend emerge and they'll be going like, oh, why do we do that? So I think, it's a shame on two counts. I think, A, it's a shame because I think we stifle a bit of innovation. And also, where are the next generation of managers going to come from? You want managers to populate the bigger firms. Well, a lot of the time, these guys cut their teeth in smaller firms. And if he or she hasn't had the opportunity to cut their teeth with, decent assets under management, then, does that actually cut off the supply to the bigger firms later in life when they want a good PM? Maybe they're all looking at it and saying, oh, it's all going to be robots anyway, it doesn't matter. But I think there's a problem there. And to say, a broader problem for me on the industry thing is, let's think about how big these managers are in terms of the market capitalization in which they're trading.
Well, Colin, we know it's all going to be machines, because as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that survey said that, what was it, 99% of firms are using AI now.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. AI got a bit of a kick in on some of the panels yesterday, I have to say. It was quite fun.
And speaking of panels, there was one thing I wanted to ask you, which was, obviously, so we published yesterday, we had an exclusive story about 360T and their attempt to, I think the headline was, to drag swaps trading into the 21st century. And I guess essentially the argument there was that we've seen a lot of kind of evolution and technology thrown at the spot market, obviously, some time ago. There seems to have been a focus recently kind of on NDFs and options, but still, swaps has lagged behind. And obviously, this is something that you wrote about extensively in your columns recently. So I wanted to get your thoughts on A, the article, and B, you had a kind of a panel discussion yesterday kind of on this topic. So talk me through your thoughts here.
Well, I think 360T are probably slightly ahead of the game in what they're doing, because my sense is that there's going to be four or five platforms pushing through the door at the same time, and if they can get out in front of it, this could actually be a genuine first mover advantage.
I have heard rumors of other people working on similar type things.
I mean, we know EBS have been revamping theirs. They've been looking at that for a while now, and I think it's inevitable that some of the other platforms will do the same. Obviously, Refinitiv still has its forwards platform. It's doing close to 400 yards a day in non-spot, so it's going pretty well. But there's another 2 yards out there that gets executed every day that is still Yesterday was interesting because I was speaking to people afterwards. It was one of those panels that was a little bit slow to get going because we had five people, and you moderate as much as I do. It does make it a little bit unwieldy, but it kind of worried me, and it worried a few people in the audience I spoke to afterwards. And they were saying, well, actually, we're not sure anything's going to change. Everyone's talking about ideas, but no one's really sort of, Simon Jones from 360 was on the panel, and he put forward some of the arguments that, you've got in your piece published yesterday. And the other panelists were like a little bit skeptical about it. And then someone else is saying, well, why are we even worrying about clearing? Let's just futurize it. There's a bit of book talking, obviously, going on.
Yeah.
It kind of strikes me at the moment that there's all these people, we're all pushing in different directions, and this is properly one for the teenagers out there. But I made a note of it would have been mid-80s, as I say, properly one for the teenagers. But there were two products out there, one called an FXA and one called an ERA. I can't remember which way around they were. One was run by Midland, developed by Midland. One was developed by Barclays, and these basically were like futurized or NDFs. But in G10, for want of a better word, you trade them like an FRA. Neither bank would talk to the other one about it. Neither bank would trade the other one's product. So in the end, they both withered and died, and we went back to the normal forwards market. Something similar happened a few years ago with Goldman's and Deutsche. They both had FX indices where you could trade an FX index, and they provide liquidity, but they weren't providing liquidity to each other. They needed others to do it. They weren't wanting to do it. And again, we withered and died. And I kind of got worried yesterday thinking, we've got people pushing for this limit order book. And I think there's an important nuance there. It's a limit order book, not a central limit order book. And I think most people agree it would be dark to some degree to allow that negotiation process, which is going to be key to it. There was this sort of one push for, we think the future is going to be this like limit order book, allied to the usual, RFQs and so on, with a cleared solution on the back end for those players that want to access it. And they know that the, increased margin rules as they come in, they start to impact more and more people in the next 2 years. That will be the catalyst for that change. And then you had the others going, well, actually, no, I just think the simple solution is just futurize it, you know, make the futures products more bespoke. I think, you know, SGX have done that, obviously, in Asia. I kind of looked at it and thought, are we going to sit here and argue about which models are best for 2 or 3 years and end up doing nothing? And yeah. I wasn't the only one with that impression. So I think there's still a degree of pushback on that subject. What was interesting to me was people were saying the data now is very good in FX swaps, so execution quality can be judged, which could be more attractive to the buy side in using like a limit order book. I mean, it was an interesting session, but it just left me a little bit bemused. I'm thinking, yeah, nothing. I couldn't see a clear solution coming out of it. And I mean, hopefully, it's just a thing we're going to debate for a year, and then something will emerge. Or, yeah. as I think 360T are hoping, from as it says in your article, that event, this by getting out there and giving people a solution that works, that they can use and they can get used to, that actually will just force the market there. The way we did when Reuters launched, there wasn't a lot of support for Reuters matching when it launched in 1992, but within weeks. The banks were playing in the EBS, so these things can swing around pretty quickly. So I think, I'm like cautiously optimistic. I think, I was optimistic. Now I'm cautiously optimistic. It kind of sort of set me back a bit, but I think we'll get there anyway.
And another thing to come out yesterday. Obviously, I couldn't be at the conference yesterday, but I saw tweeting about
house arrest.
Yeah, I am still under house arrest in the US. I saw tweeting about your trade of the year. Apparently, Nokia Max was a topic of conversation at the event.
Yeah, close. I'm using a bit of license here, but one of the speakers on the global macro panel sort of turned around and said, we like the idea of going long emerging markets, something like the Max, and going short a commodity currency like the Aussie or the Nokia. And of course, I'm immediately there. I'm like, zing, Nokia Max is my trade of the year. Here we go. So very enthusiastically tweeted it.
And then which way round were you and which way round were they?
That's what struck me. About 10 minutes later, I'm thinking, hang on a minute, I think I bought Nokia Max, didn't I? And they're saying, sell it. So yes, my trade of the year was kind of mentioned. But, it's me versus, I can't remember which panelist he was, but it's me versus, it's me versus the clever people, not for the first time in my life.
PhD.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And actually, I did check my Nokia Max the other day. Earlier today, and I was like, I've gone from 150 points up to 100 points down. So, volatility is a bit disappointing in that pair. I was expecting something much crazier than that. But
there's still time.
A moment of enthusiasm followed by the cold dawn of reality.
The crushing realization.
I'm an idiot. One other thing I think gave me a bit of a chuckle, and I actually said this yesterday on the panel. You'll be pleased to know that I did manage to introduce our speaker from Euronext FX. Although I did immediately follow up by saying, you do know you're going to be called Fast Match still for another 10 years. And at one stage, I think I called them Furonext.
Furonext, I quite like it.
Yeah, exactly. I think it could have something in it. But any thoughts on this? I mean, no.
Well, I chuckled when I read the. So this is a line from the press release announcing it. While the Fastmatch brand name is synonymous with speed and best-in-class technology, Euronext stands for transparency, regulatory robustness, fairness, and accountability. Which kind of made me chuckle. It's like, yeah, I know. Like everyone always bangs on about like, oh God, we have this amazing technology and everything. But really, what we need to be pushing is that we have a lot of great accountants at this place.
Yes, we can check things. Yes. I mean, I wonder if it's just an opportunity to get away from some of the good names out there. Like when they did when they introduced the symmetrical last look, where they managed the last look, and somebody a wit would contact me and said, so they called this one Last Match. So I wonder if they're trying to get away from things like that.
To be fair, I actually spoke to someone about Fast Match about this. And they kind of did explain some of the thinking, which was, first of all, as you say, the people who they already have on the platform trading are just going to call it fast match for like forever,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And that's not going to make any difference. But the whole point is they're trying to kind of expand out of kind of the, let's call it kind of the prop trading, you know,
yeah.
sophisticated bank and attract like a broader segment, you know, say asset managers, et cetera, right?
Mm.
And when they're doing that, the idea of being fast matching isn't like necessarily, A, they don't necessarily know that brand. They know Euronext, they don't know fast match. So if you're
yeah.
going in and trying to sell that, it's like, what is this thing? Is this like a joint venture you have with somebody or is this, you know, like a side project? I don't know what it is. And also
mm.
having that emphasis on speed, and kind of, and that isn't necessarily as important as sad as it is to say, transparency, regulatory robustness
yeah.
probably actually is more exciting to some of these firms.
Well, and also to go back to your to the point we started this podcast with, it's a nice completion of the circle. They're less obsessed with speed, just generally.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Industry. You know, these platform providers, I think, are also looking at in the future with the problem with speed. Going like, well, this is going to, the quicker I get, the more data I'm creating, and I've got to actually manage this data, distribute the data, and store the data. Maybe I don't want to be spending my money on that. I don't know, but so yeah, I mean, I think it was inevitable. The minute they bought
yeah.
Fast Match, anyway, and I think it became even. Yeah, I mean, if. You'll be surprised to hear that I put my cynics hat on a few times yesterday.
No.
Yes, exactly, much to the shock of everyone in the room. But, yeah, the cynic in me also says this is probably also Euronext trying to distance themselves from the previous management of Fastmatch, given their falling
yeah.
out with Dimitri. So I think there's an element
yeah.
of that involved as well. Yeah, we all knew
it
was Dimitri's baby.
Yeah, and also you had even, like, you had the whole kind of funky ownership where it was like FXCM had a piece and then Dimitri
yeah.
had a piece and then...
Yeah.
So I think this is probably, yeah, just a kind of a cleaner way
yeah.
of having the thing branded.
They're trying to draw a line under it probably. We'll see how they go. All I can tell them is that yesterday I had conversations with people that mentioned Hotspot, Reuters, not even Thomson Reuters. EBS, yeah, I mean, it's just the list goes on. So, yeah, good luck with that
yeah.
one, guys.
So one thing I wanted to just highlight before, because we've waffled enough for this week, which was obviously
yeah.
we had our EFX Eye on the Client Awards yesterday.
Waffled? Cutting insightful analysis, if you don't mind.
but now I would like to highlight to listeners that the Reader's Choice Awards, the voting is now open.
Yeah.
And before anybody emails, calls, asks, texts, two things I would say. One, no, you cannot vote for yourself. And also, please don't try because someone in our office, not me, thankfully, has to go through and check all the Gmail and non-work registered accounts and look them up on LinkedIn and see who they are because there's always a few people, and they know who they are, who try and vote for themselves every year.
How
secondly,
did I get that job then? Because that's me.
you're just slowest out of the gate, Colin, to pass it on to someone else. It's like a hot potato around the office, and you got left with it. Talking about speed.
Yes.
And the other question I always get is how do we win? And
yes.
I don't know how to answer for this because it's like it's a voting. The people the most vote wins, so you win by getting people to vote. I don't know how to like to say it in a more simple explanatory way than that.
Yeah.
It's
yes.
voting. Get people to vote.
Yes.
That's how you win. There's no
yeah.
there's no kind of system to game here.
No. Yeah. There's basically there's in every school box for the next 4 weeks there's gonna be a link to the voting page. It's very simple, you know, just type in a few names. Yeah, I mean just to reiterate what Gavin says, please don't vote for yourself. And please if you're a technology vendor, don't put yourself down as the best market maker in Commonwealth currencies or in the major in G3. It's just like you're looking at there's regulatory issues coming up here. We see it. Believe me, I've had firms literally vote for themselves in every box available.
Yeah.
And wow, what an organisation this is. You know. Yes. So on that warning to our readers and listeners, please vote, but please vote. I sound like one of these adverts. Please vote responsibly. we will leave it there. We will be back next week. As always, feedback welcomed. and we can give her something to discuss. Thanks very much for listening, and have a good week, and we'll speak to you soon.